Hello and welcome in.
Because he shows them the magic and mystery of science in everyday life.
On Science Mixtape on Soho Radio.
Hello and welcome to Science Mixtape with me, Kyle Major. We normally think of our senses as divided, as separated into sight, smell, taste, touch and hearing, and each is a unique and individual way that we can perceive the world. But this might not necessarily be the case. My guest today is Janice Wang. Janice is a researcher in experimental psychology who looks at the boundaries between our senses and how they interact. She is discovering that the division may not be as defined as we once thought. So, to unmix this sensory muddle, welcome Janice.
Oh, thank you, Kyle. It's nice to be here.
It's great to have you on. And so we're going to be exploring a little bit about how taste can be affected by other senses with some of our own experiments here in the studio. And so to follow along, you need to grab some chocolate. A nice high percentage cocoa solids would be just perfect. And we're also later going to be doing a little bit of wine tasting here on the show to give you some, we can say, unconventional pairings. But first, before we delve into that, Miriam has a riddle for us that is sensory related. What do you have this week?
Good morning, Science Mixers. So today's riddle is, I have no eyes, ears, tongue and nose, yet I see, hear, taste and smell everything. What am I? So I'll repeat that one more time. I have no eyes, ears, tongue and nose, yet I see, hear, taste and smell everything. What am I? So if you think you know the answer, then tweet us at Science Mixtape. We look forward to your answers.
Yeah, if you know that, do get in touch. We're just going to dive straight in and kick off with your first song, Janice, which is Cherry Blossom by Air. Why did you choose this?
Well, it might seem like an interesting choice. I chose this song because this was the first song I used where I actually experienced an enhancement effect of taste by music. So a few years ago when I was at the MIT Media Lab, I did a demo where I made this mixture of a water that's been infused with cilantro and mint and lemon. And I played different music for people while they tasted this, you know, scented water mixture. And for that particular piece, I got a really strong effect of people saying, wow, this music really enhanced the freshness and herbalness of the water.
Cross-modal perception is perception that involves interactions between two or more different senses.
Right, okay. Before we get into cross-modal perception, let's wind it back. Let's go back to the beginning. I mean, Janice, what is a sense?
You asked a really good question. Actually, it's a very philosophical question. What is a sense? So actually, philosophers have thought about what is the sense in different ways. So for example, we can try to differentiate our senses based on sensory organs. So you can say that, well, sight is a sense because you see things with your eyes, or that hearing is a sense because you detect things with your ears.
Yeah, that seems obvious. You know, if you can, that, those are the, when people are learning senses as a kid, right, you like point to eyes and ears and mouth and nose. That's obvious.
Right. And until you get to things like, you know, pain or temperature perception, and then, you know, where is the organ? Is it the skin? But the tongue can also detect temperature, you know, then it gets complicated.
Right, yeah.
Or, for example, the sense that I study, which is, well, taste or flavor, which are different. It gets really controversial because, well, okay, you pick up taste on the tongue and you get smell from the nose, but you know, flavor is this combination of taste and retronasal aroma and, you know, oral somatosensation and touch and temperature detection.
Yeah,
and
like there's this mouthfeel, right? Things,
yeah.
That's involved in the flavor of something. Is it crunchy or smooth? Or
right. So then you get into the situation where there might be, you know, multiple organs involved in this flavor detection, and then it gets slightly more complicated than the traditional.
Yeah, because apart from these traditional five senses, there's there are these other senses that are fascinating, like ones that I was reading about, which is one like proprioception.
Yeah. Which it's like the sense of, you know, your own body and knowing, you know, where's my hand and where's my leg. And
yeah, that's great. I mean, you close your eyes, you know where your hands are, but just because you just do. That's like a sense you have.
Yeah.
Where is that organ? I find that quite interesting.
I think it's, in the brain, which is why, you know, when people have, you know, amputees, they still feel the phantom limb effect, even though physically it's not there anymore, but the brain thinks it's there. So
yeah, that's amazing. And there's a whole list of other ones like pain or hunger or suffocation. I'd never really thought of that as a sense.
Me
but
neither.
You know, there's this sense where like you know when you're suffocating, you have like this completely different sensation, which is not, you know, anything else. It's not really pain, it's not really something. So I think it's quite interesting that these senses do have, you know, are quite hard to define.
Mm-hmm.
But your research is limited just to the five senses we know, or well, let's say. Oh, I'm getting evils across here in the studio. Maybe not limited, but
whoa.
So what is it that you're doing? What is it with you're doing with these senses of taste and yeah. mouth feeling?
So first, when you say, you know, our research deals with the five senses, well, so my lab is called the Cross-Modal Research Lab, and I mean, yeah, I suppose most of the research actually in this kind of cross-modal perception is really limited to audition and sight, right? Because those are the two senses people study the most. But we also do a little bit of smell, and I work on taste and sound. We actually don't do touch very much. And actually, I do a little bit of work with temperature and trigeminal senses as well, like spiciness.
All right. Which is, I always thought it was kind of like a pain. You know, is it related to that? Or
Well, trigeminal sense is also related to like when you eat mint and you get that minty sensation.
Yeah.
It's also the same. And you can argue, well, yeah, because too much trigeminal stimulation is pain. But where do you draw the line? So,
yeah, that's interesting. When is it pain and when is it just like a pleasurable, spicy thing?
Yeah.
So what kind of connections have you found between these different senses?
So again, my research mostly is based on sound and taste. One thing that I study is how kind of the basic attributes of sound can match with different basic tastes. And by basic tastes, I mean things like sweet, sour, bitter, salty, you know, umami. And then some people say, well, metallic is also a basic taste and fattiness is also a basic taste. So, you know, with anything, there's never a simple shortcut answer. But most of my study deals with sweet, sour, salty, and bitter. And I look at how those tastes might be associated with common auditory properties like, say, pitch, which is a big one. So, you know, for example, sweet and sour tends to be matched with high pitch and bitter tends to be matched with low pitch. Or I look at, say, harmony, so whether something is consonant or dissonant. So again, maybe unsurprisingly, sweetness is usually associated with consonants, whereas bitter and sour tends to be associated with dissonance.
Yeah, I mean, you pull a nice face when you taste something sweet, but you don't necessarily pull a nice face when you taste something sour. And I think very much the same when you listen to music. It just kind of clashes a bit, right? It's a bit dissonant. So, I mean, are these effects all the same? Are some more intense than others? Or is this just, you know, are you finding that there are really strong connections and some that just don't exist at all?
So actually, something we've found is this kind of research of studying between sound and taste, it's only been going on for maybe the last, you know, 5 years, 5 to 10. And some researchers have composed a series of soundtracks that are designed to really match with each sense. So, for example, in studies, we've shown that sweetness is matched with consonants, with high pitch is also matched with piano and kind of legato articulation. So some composers have taken that and made soundtracks out of them. And I've done a study that kind of compared of all the soundtracks that's been made, how people match taste with these soundtracks. And we find that people are actually really good at matching sweet tastes. Right. And they're not so good at, actually salty is the worst, which is interesting.
It's hard to pin down.
Yeah.
So we're going to be doing a little bit of this later. We've got some chocolate and we're going to try and try out some different tracks and see if we can pick out the different flavors. But we're first going to have your second song. which is Liszt, and it's Petrarch's Sonnet 1-2-3 from the second Years of Pilgrimage Suite. And this version's by Wilhelm Kempff. Why did you choose this?
Well, I chose this music because when I moved to the UK about 2.5 years ago, I started this art movement called Crossmodalism with a group of researchers and chefs and musicians. And we got together and we started doing these multi-sensory, you know, performances. And one of my first assignments was to pick a wine that would match actually with all three of Petrarch's sonnets. And this was my favorite one, so I thought I'd play here.
Experimental psychology is a branch of psychology that uses scientific methods to research the mind and behaviour.
So, we're going to have our own experimental psychological experiments in the studio now. So, we've got some chocolate here, Janice. I'm just going to open this up. What are you going to do today?
Well, so today I'm going to try probably one of our most classic demos with sound and taste. I'm going to ask you to eat some dark chocolate. Very hard task, I know.
Yeah, that sounds terrible.
But it's not so easy because I want you to listen to some pieces of music while you're eating the chocolate at the same time. And the tricky part here is I want you to pay attention to, the sound of the music and the taste of the chocolate at the same time. So I know most people are used to doing either one or the other, but I want you to kind of focus your attention on both of them at the same time.
Okay, try and do both. Okay, so I'm gonna hand a piece over to Miriam here. There you go. And then we've got our first. You want to join us here in seeing this? I guess you've done this a few times.
Well, actually, I've never tried it with this green and blacks.
Oh, okay. So some new chocolate. We'll see if it works.
So we have actually two mini experiments here. We have two pairs of soundtracks. For the first pair, maybe I shouldn't say what.
No, yeah. Let's see what people can try along at home. And
I'll just say there's two soundtracks.
Yeah, there's two
and
soundtracks.
And we're going to listen. So eat half of your chocolate when listening to the first one, and then eat the other half of the chocolate when listening to the second one, and kind of see if you notice any differences.
All right, so here we've got the first one here. I'm going to try this along. All right, so that was our first track, and let's do the second one first,
yeah,
and then we'll see
yeah.
Whether what we can pick out from either.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so now we're going to go to our second track, and we'll see how this tastes. So those are our first two tracks, and I don't know. I felt like on the first one, I don't know. Maybe it didn't really affect the. Well, maybe it's the same thing. It didn't really affect the taste so much as the mouthfeel. I felt like the first one was like a bit sharper, whereas the second one was like more crumbly. I don't know. That seemed to be my taste.
Really?
What did you think, Miriam?
So for the first one, I found it was like nice and like smooth,
mm-hmm.
and like. It had more flavour than the second one, I think.
I think that's true.
Yeah.
The second one was like a bit...
Just not as good.
Yeah, a bit devoid of flavour.
Well, actually, so it sounds like you guys both prefer the first soundtrack
yeah.
to the second
yeah,
one,
yeah.
just in terms of how good it makes the chocolate taste. Because whenever we do experiments, instead of asking people, you know, well, in addition to asking people to rate the taste, we also ask them how much do you like the chocolate. And that's actually a really important part of our studies, because, you know, after all, if say you want to do a commercial application with, you know, this kind of music and taste pairing, you really want people to like the food better, right? It's not just about changing the taste, it's whether they like it or not. So
okay, so let's go on to the second one. We're going to do the second experiment now, and then we're going to go back and we'll see what you found when you were doing your studies, what you associated with. So this is the first track of our second one. So I'm just going to divvy out some more chocolate here. Hey, there you go, Miriam. There's some for you, and I got a little bit here. Okay, so now we're going to have the first track of our second experiment. So that was the first one of our second experiment. And now we're going to go on to the second track of our second experiment. Here we go. Another piece of chocolate, everyone. On you go. So there we go. Done with that. So I, on that second experiment, I definitely preferred the first track.
Really?
Again.
Me too, yeah.
I found it made me chew it in a different way. Like the
oh,
first
yeah,
one,
yeah, yeah.
I was like, I took a bit more time.
Mm-hmm. I was just going to say the same.
No, because it was slower and kind of, and the second one was just kind of crunchy and you want to match the speed of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so this experiment is essentially what you're doing. What results did you get from playing these tracks and how does it actually differ?
Okay, so I think now I can reveal the answer of what those soundtracks are supposed to do. So for the first experiment, the first soundtrack you heard was actually a soundtrack that's been composed to match with sweetness, whereas the second soundtrack was composed to match with bitterness.
All right, so yeah, so I enjoyed the first one a bit more. Maybe, and that's yeah, and people usually pulling out do. The sweetness of the...
Yeah, and this is actually quite common. We'll do this with 70% chocolate. Of course, in the actual experiment, people don't know that they're eating the same chocolate. You know, whereas here, you clearly could see that you're eating the same chocolate. And yeah, we found that with the sweet soundtrack, compared to the bitter soundtrack, people would rate the chocolate both as more enjoyable and also sweeter. And for the second experiment, we have two soundtracks. The first one was supposed to be creamy, and the second one was supposed to be more crunchy. I think that was perhaps more obvious.
Yeah, I think so. And I think actually that really got into my head, and I did like change the way I was eating yeah. it. I was eating it as though it was something crunchy, and I was eating it as though it was something smooth. So.
Yeah, and
I definitely felt that one. Yeah.
Yeah, and for the second set, we actually did the experiment at the Music Instrument Museum in Brussels.
All right.
And we had a Belgian chocolatier who, you know, helped us by donating chocolate samples.
And well done.
Yeah, we had something like 200 people do the experiment. Yeah, and we found that the creamy soundtrack made the chocolate taste more creamy and actually also sweeter.
Oh yeah, so. Yeah. I kind of got a bit of sweetness out of the first track and the second experiment as well.
Yeah.
Wow. So we've done some real experimental psychology experiments in the studio today, and it was really hard work, guys. It was terrible eating chocolate and everything. So let's move on to your third song, Janice.
Okay.
Why did you choose this? So this is something I'd never heard of, but you've got a kind of a spicy soundtrack. Which is by IV Audio Branding.
Yes.
Where did this come from?
Well, Steve Keller, the CEO of IV Audio Branding, met my advisor, Charles Spence, at a conference years and years ago. And about 2 years ago, he came to Oxford to kind of just chat and visit. And then we got to talking and, you know, I grew up in Texas, so we had a southern connection. So anyway, we thought we'd do something together, and no one has ever looked at spiciness and whether there's a sound that can correspond with spiciness. So we did a series of studies that looked at, you know, which sonic attributes do people match with spiciness? And it turns out that spiciness is matched with high pitch, high dissonance, and fast tempo. So based on those attributes, Steve and his team composed the soundtrack that's supposed to match with spiciness. And we have actually studies. The paper was just published a few months ago showing that it can actually enhance people's perception of spiciness in food.
Brilliant. Here we go. The spicy soundtrack.
Since wine tasting relies on wine smelling, women tend to be better wine tasters than men because they have a better sense of smell.
Oh, right. Okay. Fair enough. So, yeah, we're going to do a little bit of wine tasting. Given your research, you actually have a bit of a foodie background. What did you do before getting into this?
Oh, I did. Well, what didn't I do? But no, I went to pastry school in Paris, you know, for a while when I was bored. And the other thing...
That's an interesting thing to do, yeah.
Yeah. And the other thing I did is... So I did a bunch of certifications with WSET, Wine and Spirits Education Trust. And then, of course, when I came to Oxford, I discovered blind tasting, especially competitive blind tasting, where you're given a glass of wine... You can't see the bottle, of course. And then just based on what it looks like, what it smells like, what it tastes like. You have to deduce, you know, make an educated guess on where is the wine's from, what's the grape variety, and what's the age of the wine. And it's really fun.
Yeah, that's quite interesting. So yeah. We've actually got some wines here, and I'm just going to open this one, and there we go. Makes a lovely sound. And the sun is past the yardarm here, so we're allowed to do this. So what do we have here? Why don't you have a little introduction to each of them? And you've got a kind of unconventional pairing. What are we going to do?
Yeah, so I thought what I'd do is I have two wines here that I personally really like. And what I usually do at my talks is that I'll walk people through a standard, wine tasting procedure. So, you know, what to look for in the wine to kind of tell you clues about what it could be. But the kind of cool addition that I have on the side is I also chose music that I thought would pair especially well with the two wines. The first wine we have is a Dr. Lucen 2015 Slate Hill Riesling. I am a big fan of Rieslings. In general, I like high acid wines. And Dr. Lucen is like one of the classic producers of Mosel Riesling. And the second one we have a Chablis from Burgundy. So again, this is also a white wine. Again, very mineral, very high acid. And this is a Vaucorean Fils 2015.
Okay, cool. So we're going to pour out, I think we're going to start with the Riesling.
Yeah.
So what are we looking for in this wine?
Okay, let me...
So we're just, Janice is just pouring us a solid measure there.
Yes, nothing like drinking for breakfast.
Exactly. That's what I like to hear. So here you go, Miriam, here's one for you.
Thank you.
Here we go.
Great. So why don't you talk us through, and maybe put on the song in a bit, and we'll have a little
Taste. So let me just quickly talk you through this wine. I'm sorry for the listeners at home who don't have this in front of you. So this wine is a very, Mosel Rieslings tend to be very pale, and we would call this almost a water white color, very pale lime. And you can see a little bit of spritz in here, which might come from the fact that it was in a screw cup bottle. So... I know we have plastic cups, which is not the best for smelling.
It's not ideal, sorry.
But the notes that I usually pick up on a Mosel Riesling, and this one in particular, is there's a lot of citrus. So a lot of lemon, kind of almost a green lemon, and a little bit of white flowers in the back. And I know this is what I'm about to say is controversial, but I really pick up minerality from this wine. And it's this... kind of a slaty mineral, if this makes any sense. So on the palate, this wine is off dry, which means that there is some residual sugar here. It's very high acid, which is a distinguishing feature of Riesling. It's very light bodied and kind of quite low in alcohol. I think this one has, 8%? 8.5%. And actually, just based on high acid, off dry, and low alcohol, you can probably deduce that okay, we have a Riesling here, probably from Germany.
Cool. So, yeah. You've chosen this track to pair with it, which is Ravel. What kind of things are we pulling out from this as well?
Yeah. So the way that I pick music is based, you know, partly on my research, which shows. You know, this wine is quite light on the sweet. It's sweet and sour, which would match with like a high-pitched piano music. And also, I think sourness is matched with kind of a fast tempo. So this music really has this flowing consistency. And, you know, part of it is also just me being poetic. And I feel like drinking a Riesling reminds me of a river stream running over some rocks. And this really has that kind of transparent stream feeling.
This wine really is delicious. I'm really enjoying this very much. And especially with this, let's have a little bit of a Ravel. That's just great. I'm sitting here just enjoying this, forgetting that we've actually got a show to do. So what have we got next? We're on to our next wine now.
All right, so let me pour the next one, which is the Chablis. And I think the beautiful thing about Chablis is that people usually pair it with seafood. And you know, millions of years ago, the vineyards of Chablis was actually the sea floor. So if you look in the soil under the vineyard, you can actually find lots of shells. And I think that's perhaps why Chablis goes so well with seafood, is this kind of ancient connection with the sea.
I like that. That's very poetic. Yeah.
Exactly.
For this, we've got a sonata in D for clarinet and piano. This is by Nina Rota. And this one we have is Leslie Craven and Michael Pollock. So what are we going to pull out of this wine while we have a little listen to this?
Yeah, so the thing about Chablis that I always get is, again, slightly controversial, this minerality. But this time I get round pebbles. There's something really round about Chablis. And I think this music with that really kind of golden, again, rounded instrumental sound really brings out that smoothness of the Chablis.
Yeah, let's have a little listen. Well, yeah, really different. I'm enjoying this one as well. I'm getting what you feel about the round. It's kind of like it feels kind of full and nice. This is great. I'm enjoying this. I'm having a great time here. This is kind of like a rising trend for food to be paired with music, and there are lots of restaurants that are doing things like this.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think this comes from a better understanding of the relationship between the two of them? Is this being driven by more research?
Well, I certainly hope that it would be driven by more research. Otherwise, you know, we don't have research to do. But actually, for example, a few years ago, my lab did a research looking at how people pair music with actually fine wines. And we found that when people tasted the wine while listening to a piece of music that matched the wine, their enjoyment actually was significantly increased by about 10% compared to just drinking the wine by itself. So then I think this gives motivation for a lot of marketers or restaurateurs to want to include some sort of auditory experience, you know, just to make people's experience more enjoyable.
So do you have any kind of general pairing recommendations for any budding sommeliers out there? What kind of grape what kind of music should we choose for a particular grape?
I always thought of, you know, wine and music pairing to be similar to wine and food pairing, in terms of maybe some general principles, like you want to match intensity. And I actually published a paper a few months ago looking at what is mediating the connection between wine and music. And I was specifically looking at emotional valence, arousal, and this idea of dominance, which is how powerful something is. And what I found is that people tended to match wines with music that share the same levels of dominance or kind of power. And so if you have a really big red wine with a lot of tannins, maybe you want to pair it with something kind of heavy and big, like a Beethoven symphony. Whereas if you have quite a delicate and light wine, like the Riesling we had, maybe you want to pair it with like a delicate and light piece of music.
Like a lovely, you know, piano that we had
earlier.
So we're going to move on to your fourth song. This is Francisco Lomuto and Jorge Omar with La Melodía de Nuestro Adiós. Why did you choose this?
So we're just taking a sharp left turn to nowhere. So this is a piece of Argentine tango. In my ample spare time, you know, besides doing research and, you know, blind tasting a lot of wine, I dance a lot of Argentine tango, and I also DJ. So this was actually the music that was used in my first tango class. And, you know, they just played the song over and over and over again. So I started associating this song with me and learning tango.
Eso que entoné en tu romántico balcón para contarte bien las penas de mi corazón, brindando con mi rezo así, tesoros de emoción.
Synesthesia is a type of cross-modal perception where people associate colours with numbers and letters, or music with shapes and colours.
News.
Conditions for life found on Saturn's moons.
A new mechanism for understanding how shoelaces get untied while running.
First ever neural record of an animal's entire nervous system.
Shock absorbers helped early humans colonize North America.
A new theory of how memory gets formed.
Brilliant. I mean, let's go straight to the theory of how new memory is formed. I want to know about this. What's happening here? How do memories actually form?
Yeah, I think the traditional idea is that what happens is first we get short-term memory, and then after a while, the short-term memory gets consolidated and transferred into long-term memory. But new research published earlier this week actually showed that memory gets formed simultaneously, both in short-term and long-term storage.
Yeah, so I was always told you need like 7 recalls, right? This is this weird number that seems to come out of nowhere where you need to remember it 7 times from your short-term memory and then it gets put into your long-term memory. But that's not the case. It's a bit more...
Yeah, it seems like no, it gets formed in the same time, at the same time in different places. And then over time, your connection kind of transfers from the short-term to the long-term.
That's interesting. Cool. Yeah. So Miriam, what did you have this week?
So scientists at Harvard University have, for the first time ever, imaged the neurons or the neural system of an animal called Hydra. So Hydra is a tiny transparent creature that's related to the jellyfish. And its nervous system is basically like a net of nerves, so it doesn't have a brain. And what they did is they made the nerves sort of fluoresce in the presence of calcium. So whenever the animal moved or something, you could see all these neurons like lighting up as it moved. So you could finally see like what neurons were giving out like signals so that it could move. And this is the first time ever that they've been able to image a whole nervous system of an animal before. So they think that maybe later on this might be a way forward to sort of understanding how our brain works. So I thought that was really cool. And there's a video actually. So I'll leave a link to the New Scientist article on Twitter. And there's a video to where you can see all these neurons growing up in this Hydra, this like squishy jellyfish like animal. And it's really cool. So I'll leave a link.
Yeah, it's amazing that they're able to map a whole organism.
I know.
I'm thinking
so
maybe
cool.
You know, one day you can put this organism into a computer. You can have like a jellyfish simulation. I find this fascinating.
Yeah.
Or like ants and that sort of thing, which are a bit more complicated, I know, but hey, we're getting there. So this week, one of the big news we saw was that there are conditions for life found on one of Saturn's moons.
Yes.
So this is, I mean, everyone's heard about this, but Enceladus, which is an icy moon of Saturn, has everything that's required to support life. So this isn't proof of life on another planet, but it's evidence that there could be another place in the solar system where we could find it. Enceladus is this cold moon of Saturn. It's only 150 odd miles across, and it has a frozen ice crust, and then underneath there's a liquid ocean. And the Cassini mission, which is flew by some time ago, had detected this molecular hydrogen coming from the pole. And what that indicates is that maybe that in the liquid ocean there are kind of hydrothermal vents that are generating energy that can generate this molecular hydrogen, and that these are kind of the same places we have on Earth, and that's an ideal place for life to form. And I mean, this means that this could now be a place where life still exists, and unlike say Mars, where life we think may have existed in the past but it no longer has the conditions that are right for it. And I just think anything which could lead to the discovery of other life forms is fascinating. But you know, from that all the way down to the more mundane thing of your shoelaces coming untied.
Janice, it's all science.
What's going on here? Someone's done research to find out why your shoelaces come untied.
Yeah, and I mean, I think this was probably the biggest piece of scientific news to come out last week.
Yeah, definitely. Not the life being found on Saturn, it was the shoelaces thing.
The shoelaces.
Sure.
Well, you know, I think everyone has had this experience where, you know, you're out running and then your shoelaces get untied, so you have to tie it and you continue running, and then 10 minutes later your shoelaces get untied. So apparently people looked into how exactly this is done, and it seems to be a combination of when people are running, you're actually stepping onto the ground with something like 7 times normal gravity, which loosens the knot, and then it's the swinging of the leg which further pulls apart like the two non-loopy ends. So it's this combination of impact plus swinging leg that helps loosen the knot.
Yeah, so I also read that apparently there are two ways to tie your shoelaces.
Yeah, and apparently if you just make a slight modification in the direction in which you tie the knot, you can make a knot that doesn't come untied.
Yeah. So, and I think if you look at your shoelace, if everyone looks at their shoelace now, and the shoelace is the two loops are pointing out across your shoe, left and right, then you've tied your shoelace the right way. If they're pointing up and down, then you've made a mistake and you've tied it the wrong way. So what you need to do is make your loop go the other way around, and then your shoelaces will never come untied.
Or you just wear shoes with zippers. And
that's another solution. So the one other thing I found is actually this week there's been some new computer models and tests that explained why a particular shape of ancient human arrowhead resisted breaking.
Hmm.
So this is really fascinating. The Clovis people were people who crossed from the Asian land bridge over to North America, like, around 13,500 years ago, and they developed this stone spear tip that had a bottom that had been fluted. And researchers at Kent State University of Ohio have performed tests on these, and they've shown that this particular shape means that the base of the spear acts like a shock absorber.
Oh, wow.
And that helps prevent the tip from breaking. And
I really
like this story because it's like this evolution in tool making that ended up solving a problem that we now need computer models to solve. And I just love the kind of wisdom that exists in these prehistoric civilizations. And if you think back to when we had Thomas Prophet on the show, he showed us how to make these stone arrowheads.
Really cool.
And that was really fun. So if you want to listen to that show, go back onto Mixcloud and have another listen, or iTunes. But we're going to move on, Janice, to your fifth song.
Right.
Now, this is another change of direction, which is Sarah Evans and Suds in the Bucket. Why did you choose this?
Well, like I mentioned earlier, I did grow up in Texas. So I maybe, unfortunately, one of the things that it left me with is the love for country music. And I particularly like this song because it's all about, you know, this girl who she's 18 and then she runs away from home with some guy. And somehow this idea of, you know, independence and freedom and leaving home really resonated with me when I was 18. So I really like this song.
She was in the backyard, say it was a little past 9, when her prince pulled up a white pickup truck. Her folks should have seen it coming. It was only just a matter of time. Plenty old enough, and you can't stop love.
International Standards Organization does not include sound in the definition of flavor, even though some people do experience different flavors with sound.
So, I mean, some of this research is fascinating. What's next for it? What's the direction you're going to go in? What's the most interesting avenue you're thinking of pursuing?
Oh, well, that is a very broad question. Well, if you really want to know, you can read the last chapter of my PhD thesis.
Oh, brilliant. Yeah, send it to us.
Which I just finished writing about 2 weeks ago.
Oh, congratulations.
384 pages.
You can read all of it.
Congrats.
No, but to be serious, I think there is a lot of future directions you can take, especially in the applied side. So for, you know, food companies who want to work on marketing or branding, or like I said, restaurateurs who, you know, want to create a more interesting, different experience for people. And the other direction which we're looking at, and actually I'll be doing a postdoc on this, is looking at health benefits. So, for example, can we reduce the amount of sugar or salt or fat that people eat, but still keep up their satisfaction? So if you imagine eating, say, having a drink that's lower in sugar, but playing the sweet music while you're drinking it, maybe that would give you the same satisfaction.
It's interesting. Trying to make people, you know, taste things in very different ways. We're out of time here, unfortunately, but we're going to be able to squeeze in the answer to our riddle. Miriam, what was the solution?
So the riddle that we sent out this morning was, I have no eyes, ears, tongue and nose, yet I see, hear, taste and smell everything. What am I? So we had a few people tweet in, and Oscar actually got it right. So it's your brain.
Ah, of course. That makes sense. Brilliant. Thank you so much for joining us, Janice. How can people get in touch with you on social media or anything like that?
Oh, I do have a Twitter handle, which I don't usually use so much, but it's Our Brain Engineer. And you can, there's my website, it's chanjaninswang.com. We can also post about that. And yeah, if you just Google Janice Wayne, you know, music, wine, you'll find most of my papers.
Brilliant. And yeah, we can get in touch with all those nights. And if you enjoyed the show, let us know. You can tweet at Science Mixtape. Find us on Instagram or Facebook. What science do you want to hear more about? We're open to suggestions. If you want to listen again, you can find the show on Mixcloud or get the podcast on iTunes or any other podcast distribution network. So, Janice, we're going to finish off with your final song. What was this and why did you choose it?
Well, this is one of the songs from the movie The Sound of Noise, which is one of my favorite movies because it's really about, you know, just people kind of breaking the rules and making music wherever they are. And
brilliant. So this is Sound of Noise and Doctor, Doctor, Give Me Gas, part one. Thanks, guys, and goodbye.